Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dr. Diljit Singh, President of Physicians for a National Health Program, who reviews the many failures of the U.S. for-profit healthcare system and her group's advocacy for adoption of universal single-payer health insurance. Anne Oliva, CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, who talks about her group's opposition to the Trump administration's new policy that places almost 200,000 people currently with housing at risk of being homeless again. And Zimmel Adler of Friends of the Earth U.S., who attended the UN Climate Conference in the Parallel Peoples Summit in Belém, Brazil, reports on what was and was not accomplished at the summit. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over 300 paid lobbyists from soy and beef producers, as well as pesticide makers, flooded the COP30 United Nations Climate Summit that ended in Belém, Brazil on November 22nd. Industrial ag firms are responsible for a quarter to a third of all global greenhouse gas emissions, the primary driver of climate change. And a new investigation has found that the agricultural industry is the leading cause of deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. Climate scientists assert that it will be impossible to meet climate goals set at the 2015 Paris summit without meaningful progress to curtail rising emissions in the ag sector. There's growing frustration that the UN climate summits provide unfettered access to corporations from around the world that profit from maintaining global dependence on fossil fuels and/or the destruction of forests and other ecosystems vital for mitigating the climate crisis. An interview featured later in today's program will examine the disappointing outcome of this month's COP30 climate conference in Brazil. The recent 43-day government shutdown exposed the growing food insecurity crisis for millions of Americans who rely on programs like the federally funded Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The American Prospect observed that individuals and families who've had to turn to food banks and other charities during the benefit cutoff have had a brutal introduction to how partisan politics, driven by cruelty, directly impacts their lives. SNAP beneficiaries living in Republican-controlled states like Mississippi are far more vulnerable than those living in progressive states like California or New York. After the shutdown ended, 19 states and the District of Columbia issued full benefits, while 18 states provided partial benefits for the month, and 13 states didn't issue any benefits at all for November. The agreement that reopened the government extended full funding for the Department of Agriculture, which administers SNAP, and three other agencies through September 2026. But the Trump Republican budget passed in July will cut 20%, or $190 billion from SNAP over the next 10 years, in addition to $1 trillion in cuts to the ACA, Medicaid, and Medicare, the largest reduction in federal health care funding in U.S. history. Last year, telecom giant AT&T signed a 10-year contract with the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, worth $146 million to provide mission-critical communications services. Under Trump's second term, the company has signed additional contracts with DHS worth $25 million as ICE and Customs and Border Protection carry out the president's unprecedented and often violent campaign of mass detention and deportation. Now, organizers in Chicago and elsewhere across the country are demanding AT&T cut ties with DHS and ICE, which is part of a larger strategy targeting corporate complicity that enables the Trump regime to execute its mass deportation program, which many legal observers say violates the rule of law and human rights. Groups working with People's Action, a national network of community activists, are demanding AT&T drop its contracts with DHS and sent a boycott petition to AT&T CEO John Stankey, where signers pledged not to buy or upgrade the company's products until it cuts ties with federal law enforcement agencies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The longest government shutdown in U.S. history came to an end on November 12th, when both the House and Senate voted for a continuing resolution signed by President Trump that will keep federal agencies open through January 30th next year. The 43-day congressional impasse was overcome when 8 members of the Senate Democratic Caucus broke ranks to vote for a deal that failed to win a renewal of subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. That means without further congressional action, some 24 million Americans will likely see their health insurance premiums double or triple beginning next year, with an estimated 5 million no longer able to afford health insurance coverage. The federal budget passed by the Republican-controlled Congress and signed into law by Trump in July cut more than $1 trillion in Medicaid and Medicare over the next decade. These largest cuts to health care programs in U.S. history won't take effect until after the November 2026 midterm election. The dramatic cutbacks in funding for health programs highlights a long-running crisis that an increasing number of Americans view as a failure of our nation's health care system. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Diljit Singh, president of Physicians for a National Health Program and a practicing gynecologic oncologist. Here she reviews the many failures of the U.S. for-profit healthcare system and her group's advocacy for adoption of a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health insurance program.
The ACA cuts that are coming are impacting mostly the states that did not expand Medicaid, and then there's Medicaid cuts coming on top of that. And there have been several studies that have come out looking at what the impact of those changes will be. And I think the nicest study comes from a group that was some collaborators at Yale and Penn that basically showed that this combination of Medicaid cuts and then lack of extension of the enhanced ACA premium tax cut credits, that combination is likely to lead to over like 50,000 preventable deaths just from lack of insurance. For every million people who don't have insurance, we think that there's somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 preventable deaths. We often think of like, oh, well, Medicaid cut, that's not going to impact me because I don't personally have Medicaid, not realizing that so many rural hospitals, so many hospitals in smaller towns count on that Medicaid funding to keep their doors open. So even people who don't actually have Medicaid as their source of insurance have the strong potential to lose their local hospital. And we already have such like dramatic maternity care deserts and just, you know, care deserts in general in rural areas. I'll be honest, I think that there's things that even those of us who think a lot about this aren't foreseeing. The nursing home, the cuts to the regulation and assessment of nursing homes, that will be cut in the same bill. That reconciliation bill very, very deliberately seemed to target healthcare access and seniors in rural areas, but, you know, across our country in multiple different settings.
Dr. Singh, please summarize for our audience Physicians for a National Health Program's proposals for a single-payer, universal, and comprehensive health insurance coverage system that would cover all Americans. What are you proposing for our country in the midst of this crisis?
We don't actually need health care insurance. We just need health care. The health insurance industry essentially uses somewhere between 25 and 35 cents of every dollar to do nothing related to healthcare, right? It's either a profit, just pure profit for them, something that goes to their shareholders, or it's this kind of bureaucracy administration that's been created by, well, if you have Aetna, this is approved, and if you have United Healthcare, this is approved. And so there's layers and layers of bureaucracy at the individual physician office, at the hospital level, and then at employers level. And then, of course, these insurance industry calls it, you know, their administrative overhead, but it's this created thing. And so I think that's one piece that people don't always sort of perceive, that if we just got back that, let's just use a round number, 30%. If we just got back 30% of the whole healthcare budget in America, we could actually cover everybody, and we could give everybody vision, we could give everybody dental, we could give everybody adequate mental health coverage, things like hearing aids and et cetera that manage to bankrupt people because it's not part of their healthcare. All of those things could be included if we just took that money back. And there's a lot of people who say, well, no, I'm worried if we have a socialized system, you know, maybe we'll have long wait times. Well, I'll tell you, it doesn't matter what city you live in, it takes a long time to get in to see a primary care doctor. There's parts of the country where it takes weeks to months to get in to see specialists. And then there's, of course, parts of the countries where there aren't even specialists. And, you know, I'm saying specialists, but there's parts of the country where you can't even see a gynecologist or an OBGYN because there's not enough. You know, I think in America, we don't realize that the rest of the world, including places that have a lot less money than us, have a lot better health care and a lot better prevention in place and a lot more access to the things that can keep them healthy. So, I mean, I think the big work that we need to do is we need to stand up as citizens of the country and demand that our legislators not give in to pressure from United Healthcare or Humana or Aetna and just say, no, we think our people deserve access to health care. We shouldn't worry about how much does something cost. We should worry how effective is it, right? And so what I think we really deserve, we deserve high quality, trustworthy health care, period. I don't even think affordable comes into it, because the truth is cost effective, health care, like all of those things are things we can do. But we have to start with high quality, and the second demand be like completely trustworthy, that the people who are helping you make decisions are doing it for you, not because they're worried about how much money the hospital is making or how much money an insurance company is making.
That was Dr. Diljit Singh, president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about the U.S. healthcare crisis and her group's mission by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Among the many abrupt policy changes the Trump regime has undertaken over the past 10 months are changes it's made to federal housing policy. Instead of funding Housing First programs, a proven method for moving people out of homelessness, the administration has instead opted for a punitive approach that prioritizes temporary or transitional housing and a major cutoff of funding that will place almost 200,000 people currently with housing at risk of being homeless again. A coalition of 20 states in Washington, D.C. filed a lawsuit on November 25th to block these changes to the federal homelessness program. The number of Americans now experiencing homelessness is over 770,000, an 18% increase from 2024. The rise in homelessness is driven by many factors, including a severe shortage of affordable housing and incomes that don't keep pace with rising costs. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ann Oliva, the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization whose mission is to end homelessness in America through public policy, communication, and capacity building. Here she talks about two approaches to ending homelessness and her organization's opposition to Trump's recently announced policy.
The executive order that was released by the White House at the end of July that sort of provided the roadmap for how the administration intends to change its policies related to homelessness in particular. What that document did was to say to the field that the administration intended to deprioritize Housing First programs, which is an evidence-based approach to ending homelessness that prioritizes housing as the base by which people can receive services that they need to heal from trauma, address some of their underlying issues, and that sort of thing. The first item is the executive order, increasing institutionalization, including forced institutionalization of people who are experiencing homelessness and might have mental health conditions. They also talk about camping bans and criminalization of people experiencing homelessness. And then the first time that we saw a notice of funding opportunity under the auspices of this new executive order was something called the Continuum of Care Builds Notice of Funding Opportunity, or NOFO. That NOFO included a number of criteria. It was the third time that it was issued, and this third one was issued at the beginning of September with a very short turnaround, 1 week. It was for development of permanent supportive housing. And it included many of the things that the executive order laid out and that were laid out in other executive orders, specifically around what the administration considers DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. It had requirements around how communities have to work with law enforcement on immigration issues, and a number of other things. That notice of funding opportunity has been halted by the courts because it is subject to a temporary restraining order until the merits of the case can be heard by the judge. And then on the first day back after the government shutdown, we saw the Continuum of Care NOFO, regular Continuum of Care NOFO, be released. That is for $3.9 billion. So overall, it is not a cut to the overall program. But what it does do is it caps permanent housing at 30% of a community's total amount. So in practice, what that means is that because HUD, that program, about 87% of the money in that program is used for permanent housing, and it is now capped at 30%. There are a lot of permanent housing programs that will lose their funding over the course of 2026 if the NOFO is not stopped either through legislative means or through the courts. About 270,000 people are served at a given point in time in the COC program, and about 170,000 will lose their permanent housing program.
If it's capped at 30%, what's the 70% of the funding going to go to?
Supportive services only programs, which can be things like street outreach. So they've prioritized those kinds of interventions over permanent housing interventions.
So that's kind of like keeping people homeless, not moving along the path toward finding a home. Is that right?
I think that's right. The administration is prioritizing these short-term interventions that for street outreach have to work with local law enforcement and immigration services, which is really hard for street outreach workers to do because the street outreach worker usually tries to build trust with a person who's living unsheltered. They would have to participate in encampment closures. So there are a number of changes even to the structure of those interventions. And I would dare to say it's a reversal back to the 80s and early 90s before permanent housing became a priority for people experiencing homelessness.
That was Ann Oliva, CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Learn more about the struggle to constructively address the U.S. homelessness crisis and oppose the criminalization of homeless people by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This year's United Nations Global Climate Summit, held in Belém, Brazil, ended on November 22nd with a formal agreement that conspicuously failed to address The central issue of phasing out fossil fuels, the main driver of the climate crisis, and didn't even mention fossil fuels at all. While delegations from 194 nations participated in this year's UN COP30 conference, Donald Trump, who says climate change is a hoax, sent no one and announced a series of sweeping proposals to roll back environmental protections and encourage fossil fuel drilling. During the conference held in the city that's the gateway to the Amazon rainforest, 80 developing countries, along with the United Kingdom, Germany, Mexico, and Brazil, demanded an agreement on a roadmap to transition the world away from fossil fuels. But major fossil fuel producers, Russia and Saudi Arabia, opposed any timetable to phase out the use of oil, gas, and coal. Colombia and the Netherlands responded by announcing a plan to host the first international conference in April to focus on the phase-out issue. Climate scientists at the conference also urged a rapid transition away from fossil fuels, declaring the planet is approaching a tipping point from which there is no return. Your reporter spoke with Zimmel Adler, senior forest, land, and climate finance policy advocate with Friends of the Earth U.S., who attended COP30 and the Parallel People's Summit in Belém, and reports on what was and wasn't accomplished at the summit.
What was accomplished in Belém, Brazil, at the headwaters of the Amazon rainforest, were basically some baby steps. The Mitterrand text, which is the overall flagship outcome document that outlines the sort of consensus that was reached among the parties, has a lot of language around, you know, the need for further multilateral action. And it reiterates a lot of the very grave concerns regarding huge gaps in adaptation and mitigation finance, you know, finance that goes to countries that are on the front lines of climate change to help them basically adapt and prepare for future climate catastrophes. And also it named that there's not been enough reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, the magnitude of the risks that we're facing. And it called on parties to make further commitments in their strategies for this. But we didn't actually leave the COP with some important concrete deliverables. And there are many concerns with even the outcomes on the climate finance side. The call for scaling up finance for developing countries to $1.3 trillion per year and a tripling of adaptation finance. That's important, but the reality is that these outcomes from the COP left out deforestation and a roadmap to ending deforestation. It left out the roadmap to phasing out fossil fuels. There is not enough guardrails on ensuring public finance flows to climate finance adaptation for countries on the front lines of the climate crisis. And even in the work plan that was delivered on a just transition, there's some major concerns about workers' rights and human rights and how that's actually understood on a pathway to a just transition. So, you know, without including a phase out of fossil fuels, no forest protection roadmap, despite this being an earlier version during the negotiations, it essentially is underscoring this voluntary action. And I really think that these voluntary commitments end up weakening decisions on where finance flows, especially, again, like public finance, that northern countries, those responsible historically for causing the climate crisis, should be accountable for their fair share. And instead, what we ended up seeing coming out of these meetings was a lot of voluntary and market-based private finance initiatives that are being lauded as solutions.
Well, Zimmel, from my understanding, what happened at COP30, there was really no global consensus, and there's very much a divide between many of the world's nations and the oil-producing states like Russia and Saudi Arabia. Do you see any glimmer of hope that there could be some consensus? I mean, it was very stark, maybe not surprising, that fossil fuels were not even mentioned in the final agreement when fossil fuels are the biggest driver of the climate crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was what really ended up dividing parties towards the end of the negotiation, you know, without including any mention of a phase out of fossil fuels in the final text or roadmap to ending deforestation. And, you know, also this narrative that was pushed of the forest cop. It's the cop of the Amazon. It's the cop that had the most indigenous people ever admitted, the cop of diverse representation. It didn't deliver on that. I do think it is a positive sign that nation states who, you know, were really strongly backing a phase out of fossil fuels and a roadmap to ending deforestation, which, by the way, had already been committed to achieve zero deforestation by 2030, 2 years ago. I think it's really important that we see a convergence of governments at all levels, at national and subnational levels, coming together to really deliver on a transition out of our extraction-based economy. Mm-hmm. And so having the leadership of states that want to convene outside of this kind of corporate captured process, I think is a good thing. And I look forward to, you know, watching and seeing what happens and what the agenda is and how, you know, a just transition is defined in that, in those conversations. I think that, you know, there is hope because there is a really amazing declaration that came out of the People's Summit. The People's Summit, which gathered well over 20,000 people during the first full week of the COP, really put forward a declaration that not only delivered on a very clear analysis of the problems, but also put forward a very clear pathway, a justice-oriented pathway and roadmap for how we face these challenges of the climate crisis. And I think that the march that happened over the weekend after the People's Summit of 70,000 people in the streets of Belém, uplifting calls for solidarity and action, demands across many social movements around the world, flags and banners calling for an end to environmental destruction, a feminist economy, respect of human rights, people over profit, a just transition. I think the hope really lies in the people's power building process that the People's Summit really delivered on.
That was Zimmel Adler, senior forest, land, and climate finance policy advocate with Friends of the Earth U.S. Find more analysis on the outcome of the UN Climate Summit in Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRWK in Midlothian, Virginia, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.